Hello, everyone. This is my midday show. I'm really fortunate. You know, us Key Biscayners, we meet Key Biscayners that are cooler than oneself. And here on Blink Radio, WSQF 94.5 live stream on WSQFradio.com. Yours truly, Mac and the Rock, the Rampage. I'm here with a cool subject of mine. It's not really of mine because I'm not very informed about it, but I'm blessed to run into someone in the neighborhood to explain to me mineral rights and mineral excavation and mineral investment. I have Stephanie Ashton of IG Global, who's here with us today. And welcome to the show, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much. I've been looking forward to speaking to you.
This is very amazing to run into you on a street corner. I think it's fascinating because as I told you, I had some experience trying to connect dots.
We were walking the dogs.
Yeah, walking the dogs. And total Key Biscayne. And what's beautiful about us in here in Key Biscayne, and it's really cool, it's something that people shouldn't take for granted here, but we are people who are proactive in life.
Absolutely.
In order to afford to live here, we all either come from someone or taught by someone or someone taught us, someone allowed us opportunities to learn, and we just to maintain the gorgeous lifestyle we live on the Key, we have to be like you. We got to think, and we got to think clearly, and we got to think long-term, and there's a certain tacit knowledge that I can see that you have right away that I believe I have a little bit of in mineral rights. I think it's really cool. So tell us how you got into business. I'd like to know the arc of how you ended up in this business. Go ahead. It's all yours.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate being here. I've been in the mineral exploration business, which is early stage search for minerals. And it's since 25 years now. I lived in Chile for 16. I worked in South America up until this day, I still have a company there. And in 2020, I joined IG Global Group, a premier exploration group. We had a fantastic asset in Utah, which we in 2.5 years took from an exploration project to a discovery to a mining project. We were mining and producing gold and silver within 2.5 years of starting at our project, which is really unheard of. And we did this all privately because in the public markets, it's really difficult to do that. And we ended up selling it for a multiple of like 6 times our money to a...
Now, when you say public, you mean speculative dollars using the public funds from a public traded company or...
So you can either be a public company, right? List your company on an exchange.
Typically with an incredible amount of funding.
Well, not really, because I'm in exploration. So exploration needs fewer millions to begin with.
Okay.
And you incrementally increase the value of your company. And so typically, many of these companies go public on a Canadian exchange, which is very familiar with mineral exploration, or the London Alternative Exchange, the AIM Exchange. More recently, people are going to the NYSE or the NASDAQ to do the same, because there's a crisis in funding for mineral exploration globally. And that is being picked up, actually, by the folks in Saudi Arabia, for example. There's a whole shift of mining finance that's happening.
And so the Saudis, for lack of finance, are putting monies up worldwide to increase their exploration because they can't find it in their own country?
No,
or is it because they have plenty?
On the contrary, they're a country that understands the wealth generated
under the ground
from natural resources,
yes.
Right? And they understand that copper is in extremely short supply right now. We have a whole group of the world that is building up their militaries, and we have a whole other group that is trying to do an energy transition, and all of this is very mineral intensive. And even the race in space and, you know, the things that drive Elon Musk and etc. are heavily reliant on mineral exploration,
yes,
to make the discoveries, to find the minerals that we need to make these changes, right?
I mean, nothing more impressive is lithium. I mean, I believe that that's like an old mineral already. There's other minerals coming on board that generate and hold electricity even more efficiently.
Well, surprisingly, copper is an extreme deficit situation. And it's because it takes 20 years to develop a copper mine from the time you discover it. So we need long-term thinking. We don't have long-term thinking in the U.S. We're all looking at our belly buttons. We're not really seeing the world.
And we're rushing the microwave.
There you go. And, you know, whereas the folks in Saudi Arabia are being led by a young group of people who are highly educated all over the world and who understand the benefit of minerals and mineral discovery and how critical they are for the future of, you know, military, energy transition, humanity in general. So they have 40 ministers of mining. We don't even have one. And they're
going The United States doesn't have a minister of mining?
No.
They have like a czar? Not even?
No, we have mining is attached to, I think, the Department of Energy potentially, yeah. and Department of Defense also gets involved in some of the funding. But we're so short-sighted collectively as a country, and it's really hampering our ability to develop a lot of our resources at home. So instead of us developing resources, we're developing them in Africa, in the Middle East, in South America, in Asia.
Anywhere because of the United States, because of so the difficult. Bureaucracy.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's difficult to do a mining project anywhere in the world now. The ESG standards are global. And, you know, but it's also a mindset. The value of exploring and mitigating what could be the potential challenges. For example, recently there was a project that was killed for a daisy in California.
Oh, and my Lord.
I don't know the merits of the project particularly. Maybe it should have been killed. But
for a daisy? Nah.
But it was one of the reasons, right? Maybe there were multiple reasons. But, you know, my message to people is we're exterminating lots of species in the world with the problems of climate change. So we can't change where the minerals appear on the earth.
Yes.
We need to actually go there. We can't decide,
let's go find it somewhere else because it might be over there. No, if it's right here, get it.
We can transplant a daisy. We can take a daisy and we can find a new habitat, a similar habitat, but we can't move the minerals. So I think there's an area for compromise and for reducing bureaucracy and, trying to educate our world collectively instead of all of us looking at our belly button here in the United States. I mean, we have a big world and there's a lot going on. And we're falling behind, frankly.
Now, do you believe that that some of these minerals are more vital, not so much for the mineral you're actually seeking, but the byproducts that come out of the mineral? Like I was told, tell me if I'm correct, that in the mining of copper, there's actually a derivative that comes from there that's very used or commonly used in fertilizers. Is that true, that there's... like something that...
Well, most of these minerals appear in conjunction with other minerals, right?
Right.
So they're not all going to be economically able to be developed. But copper often comes with gold. It often comes with molybdenum, which is something that you use to reinforce steel, for example.
Oh, very important. The hardener.
And, you know, and in the lithium exploration, you have other salts, potassium, magnesium, and potassium is used in fertilizer, for example.
Okay, that's probably why I came to that conclusion.
Yeah. So you're right. By mining one area that's polymetallic, you can get, you know, several streams of minerals that are required, you know, by the world today.
And today's electronics are allowing you to go deeper and deeper and deeper on first sight or first hunch?
Well, this is a very interesting question. Thank you for asking. Mining and mineral exploration has not had a major technological advance for a very long time. Oil and gas is highly advanced in its technologies in terms of exploration. And there's a big rush now to build up the technology around the needs of mining to shorten the cycle. I mentioned before it takes 20 years to get a copper mine into production from discovery to producing. And part of that is the difficulty with which it takes to actually define the deposit. So if we can shorten the time to discovery, then we can help that, and technology is about to do that. We are in contact with several artificial intelligence companies and machine learning companies that basically take a deposit that we are working on, for example, the information that we currently have. We haven't made the discovery yet, but all the smoke is there, for example. And they will take our information, whether it's geochem surface samples or whether it's drill samples that are actually core that comes from the earth that's been acid, and you can see what's in it. You can see the types of veins.
You said acid?
Assays.
Oh, assays. Please tell my audience what that is, because I don't know.
So when you have a rock, you can send it to a lab,
right?
And the lab will assay it, and the assay tells you what is in the rock.
Oh, cool. So it's like an assessment that sounds very similar.
Yeah. So it's basically a lab that gives you the assay. And the people who are developing technology will take this information and they will run scenarios of known sort of possibilities, or even kill an area and say this area is better than another area for your next, you know, exploration efforts, which are typically drilling. And that can shorten the time to discovery, because once you've made a discovery, then it's fire. It's,
now, when you say you have to describe the deposit, doesn't the regulatory agency, government official who has to approve these plans, don't they have to assume that once you start excavating, it could expand into miles?
No.
West, east, north? I mean.
No. Just to run you through sort of the typical, you have geologists, and I've had the privilege of working with the best in the world. I'm so excited. It's so much fun. Who understand the rocks that they're looking at.
Okay.
Right? And they've been all over the world. They see many systems. So they have a lot of experience coming to it. It's like going to a doctor that's done 5,000 surgeries versus a doctor that's just done one, right?
Yes.
You've seen everything.
Yeah.
And you know by the environment, the structural, the faults that are in the earth, you know, the structure of the geology,
mm-hmm.
and surface expression of things coming up, that you have a potential area of interest for mineralization. From there, you go and you do a surface sampling, which is basically you take chip samples of rocks in a grid.
On a surface.
On the surface. You send that to the lab, and the lab will come back to you with concentrations of different minerals. So let's say we're looking for a copper project. It'll come back and say, we've got high surface concentrations of copper in this area, and that usually is one first step. Then you can run some geophysics, which is basically using induced polarization and magnetometry to see if you can get any conductive bodies underneath, because copper conducts, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then you combine the geochemistry, which is the surface examples, with geophysics, and you try to do a drill target, okay? And then you put a drill.
Drill is in the actual location,
yeah,
where you believe there's concentration.
That's right. So you kind of do that pre-work. You get a permit, which takes forever. It takes a long time to just put one hole in the ground, which it would help if we could shorten that just to start. Because
you mean in the United States or just about any country?
It's becoming difficult in all countries.
For lack of specialization, or?
No, I just think that it's such a focus of, you know, disturbance of the earth and everything. And, you know, it's less than, it's like a less than an acre that's just, that's.
Impacted on by
like,
the.
It's like 10% of an acre to do a drill hole. I mean, the pads are 30 by 30 feet.
So why would they? Why?
And then you reclaim it and you put, you know, you put. So it's actually pretty straightforward. So anyway, that's kind of off on a different subject. But to get back to how these are discovered, then you drill it out. And these drill holes that go to the lab, and you build a model underground of what you're looking at by putting the information into a computer system that ties together either a vein system or a porphyry system. A porphyry system means that the mineralization is disseminated in the rock, which is great, because then you just like scoop it out. If it's a vein system, then you have to follow veins, and that's
of concentration.
Of concentration of minerals, if you're going to actually try to mine it, or they come in mantos, which are layers, for example, of mineralization.
Which is how most students learn about minerals in the earliest stages. They see layers in the sand. That's the image I have in my head.
Right.
And you just taught me to think vein.
And there's different types of hosts of mineralization. There's the sedimentary hosts, which are what you're speaking of. And then there are, epithermal, there's magma, you know, from the earth, forces that precipitate out in different stages minerals through their process of extruding from the core of the earth up to the earth's surface. They come in contact with water through faults, and water precipitates at different Water will precipitate minerals at different temperatures, for example, depending on the type of mineral it is.
And the part of the world it's at.
Concentrations, right? So anyway,
that's so fascinating. Now, how is it you get to the money side of it?
Exactly. Okay, so first of all, all this is money in the ground, right?
Right.
Until you make a discovery. So when you make a discovery, then you have something worth value. It used to be that you made a discovery and it was immediate value. Now you have to not only make a discovery, but you have to really prove that you can see a way to mining it. And people used to get excited just on discovery. Now you've got to show a way to mine it. So you have to show a friendly jurisdiction. You have to show, you know, that you have no fatal flaws on the project. So it takes a little bit more money to...
Fatal flaw meaning to humans who mine or to equipment or...
No, fatal flaws would be, for example, if metallurgically it couldn't be extracted from the host rock. Or it couldn't be extracted economically. Or because you're in, you know, you wouldn't actually go there, but you're in a national park, for example. You're never going to get a mine permitted in a national park.
No way.
So that's sort of an extreme example, but just on the, it could be a permitting issue. It could be.
Although they did find oil in Alaska that was considered a national park, and it created chaos.
Oh yeah.
And they found a way to drill over there.
Well, you know, there. That's a whole different conversation as well.
Yeah.
You know, Canada's, for example, a really good example of a country that is working with the indigenous people to be partners, because a lot of the minerals are found on indigenous lands.
Yes. And get them out of poverty, absolutely.
And they have, it's been stellar, honestly. It's been such a collaboration, such an education. I think that's something that's very translatable. But, you know, everybody has to have involvement of the local communities and the local stakeholders. There is no project that will succeed without it. So
yeah, and making desolate, remote places wealthier, man, would probably be the only political way to get bureaucrats to change minds, to allow people to go to remote areas to the benefit of the community as well as to the humankind at large and move these things along.
Well,
because the risks are vast anyway. In fact, all the risks are pretty much unpredictable. There's some things that you can...
You would think. But there are people from the outside that are not part of the local communities, that they might be in a near community where they like to go and maybe camp there or whatever.
Yes.
People that live in Los Angeles or, you know, New York, or, you know, big suburban areas that don't want their playgrounds to be contaminated.
As if that's more important than humanity.
And actually, the local communities don't have any manufacturing. They don't have any real means of creating wealth for their communities. I've seen counties, for example, that are the main employer is the government, because they, you know, they only have, you know, the roads to be looked after and things like that. Whereas if you had responsible mining, which includes reclamation at the end, right?
Mm-hmm. Reclamation would be?
When you have a mining project and it has a life of mine, let's say for 10 years, at the end of 10 years, you do a reclamation of the whole mining area, and it's part of your project before you even...
To give it back to some, make it a historical site, or just turn it into something?
Yeah, plant trees if you've excavated an area, and, you know, I mean, so you reclaim sites.
How about just filling up the mine with water? We could use some water, too.
Well, that's another actual byproduct of mining. Mining actually discovers a lot of layers of water.
Wow, that's so important to us. Yeah.
Impressively. And these waters could be used, right? For example, in the direct lithium extraction technology, which is being developed, and there are many companies competing to get this to work perfectly. But, you know, lithium from brines. So lithium comes in three different types of environments. It comes in hard rock. It comes in claystone, and it also comes in brines. Now, brines are ancient lake beds that have evaporated to the point where it's all very salty and usually covered with layers of sediments. So the idea is there's an aquifer down there. It's of no use to anybody because it's too salty and it has too many other, you know, metals or salts in it. So it has to be processed first, no matter how you look at it. But in your search for lithium, you go down to, you know, 2,000 feet or et cetera, and you find these aquifers. And direct lithium extraction takes the water out, pulls out the lithium, which is a very small percentage, and can produce fresh water.
For irrigation and farming? Absolutely. Not necessarily drinking?
Absolutely. So
therefore, the stuff that they now use for farming can be used for drinking.
Exactly.
Well, I don't see how people can't have the long view on humanity, they don't really care about the human race, for Christ's sake.
Well, I think, you know,
we're not supposed to live just on air alone.
People's concerns are well-intentioned. They're well-placed. I feel like, but we're looking...
Do you say that in terms of the populace or the bureaucrat?
No,
because here on Blink Radio, we have something to say about bureaucrats.
I'm saying generally, I think people want to do the right things that as they see them. But what we have is a lack of education, a lack of understanding.
Well, you've informed our audience how intricate the business is, that there's so many variables that we need to let you be. Do your work.
Well, we need to at least have a little bit of a help and an understanding in the early days of the process, because we're going to look at 100 things and only one might be successful. So you can imagine...
The same applies to oil. Yeah. How many times they do a bore and it just dry.
Exactly. So we have to realize how difficult it is and support all the technologies that are coming forward to help reduce the footprint of mining. Obviously, we want to do that as much as we can, be more efficient. But we also have to have the funding for it. And the funding has really sort of gone away in the traditional sense. There used to be a very robust retail market for mining stocks, and a lot of the newer generation has gone to, you know, sexy stocks, Netflix, you know.
Yeah, meme stocks.
Like meme stocks, even that, things that have absolutely no value. And so we're sort of a small sector that nobody even knows about.
And yet the most important.
And yet critical. You and I, if we took away mining, would be on the beach.
Half the equipment here in this radio station. Yeah, half of the equipment in here is the mines, the minerals you're talking about. Yeah. And this electronic equipment's got copper all over the place.
If you look out your window and you say, okay, I'm going to take everything away that had to do with mining, there'd be nothing left.
There'd be nothing.
So it's actually really critical.
So so the Saudi king, being young, bin Salman, he is what, setting a standard in terms of lines of credit? You talked about financing, I have to think that... Man, if oil money gets involved in mining, my God, isn't that the end-all be-all?
First of all, it's long-term, right? I mean, China has a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan. Saudi Arabia's got this 2030 plan that they've been on now for 3 years. After 3 years, there's a mineral symposium that they've hosted. The first year, they invited people and paid for them to come. Now, on the third iteration, that was only 500 people. On the third iteration, there were 13,000 people going all themselves.
Wow. Like bees. And you don't have to pay them to come. They just come.
Like bees to honey.
Yeah. Build it and they will come.
Because they have better financing terms, actually, partly because of their Islamic tradition about the view on finance, that it can't be onerous to people. Whereas here, we don't have that view at all, and we're not long-term. So everybody...
We think in 10 years, the Islamists and the Chinese, they think in 100.
Right.
Century thinking.
I mean, you can make very good returns. It's a longer-term investment for sure. You have to hold it at least 3 to 5 years and sometimes longer. But the returns are much higher than you would get than in a regular 5 to 10% range. And you could lose all your money as well, so we have to say that.
Is there times where you commit to the mine and halfway down there's no more and then you're burnt? Because you spent all this money to get halfway there,
and you don't find
the concentration you were looking for?
The opposite actually happens quite often.
More often.
Most new mineralization is found near existing mines.
Okay.
So actually,
the predictability is high.
There's expansion. You know, the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yeah, that's why I asked three or four minutes ago. It seemed to me that once you start mining, it could just expand, where you don't necessarily can predict how wide she gets, because you get closer and closer to a neighboring mine.
That's
and the government, why the hell would they get it? Why could they care less, you know? I mean, if it's 10 miles wide, well, then so be it. Yeah. Why would they get in your way? Because it might be, I mean, when you mean to define the mine, you're not really talking about distance on the surface or deep?
Often both. So there can be lateral expansion as well as expansion at depth. So a mine could start open pit and then go underground, for example. And you see this very often if you look at some of the major mines in the world. They tend to always have additional mineral. Now, another problem, though, is a lot of that mineral, average mineral grade, is lowering. In other words, they're having to process more tons of rock to get the same mineral out. So reasons for which new jurisdictions, such as the Congo, for example, which has become the second producer of copper just recently.
That's where you get the horror stories of the little kids mining and all that.
But there are some positive stories as well. And
but why don't the modern machines show up there? Or are they just...
No, they're very modern.
Or are they they appealing to the tribesmen, the bureaucrats? And
no, you can't have an archaic view of Africa anymore.
In other words, so the machines are there and these kids are not being used like they were in the past.
The standards are global. Mining standards are global. If you have a major mining company involved, the standards are global. So it's just the fact of the Congo is there's very high concentrations of copper. So whereas in Chile, for example, you can have a deposit whose grade, which means the percentage of copper in the rock, is 0.3, and it's still producing 0.3% copper.
And that's still profitable.
It is still profitable because of the 100 years they've been in business, right? And in the Congo, you've got 7% copper in the rock.
Oh, my Lord.
So
that's
it's a
huge
big
difference.
So you mine much less. And globally, we should endeavor to use our technologies in every way possible to be more efficient in mining. And I think there's a whole wave of that coming in. For example, we are, our company right now has two projects. One's in Mongolia and one's in Kazakhstan. And they're both copper projects. And we're looking for, you know, higher grades. And
now high grade means 10%, 7 to 10%?
It's a combination. No, anything that's above a percent in copper is considered
big.
High grade. Yeah. But, you know, it's a combination of factors. For example, if you are near a port and near transportation and even near, you know, a smelter because you get a sulfuric acid from a smelter, which you need for leaching copper oxides.
Ooh, that's a good one.
That might be too technical.
That's a rabbit hole.
That might be too technical. But the thing is, if you have a really good infrastructure and you're in sort of a cluster of a mining area, even if your grade's a little bit lower, you won't have to put in a ton of new infrastructure. If you're in a very remote place and have to spend, you know, millions, hundreds of millions on infrastructure.
Like then, a road leading to the mine.
Yeah, then you would need to have the economics justify that. Right. So the economics of any one project really depends on many things. It depends on the grade. It depends on the location. It depends on infrastructure, the cost of labor, for example.
Do you feel you got something going on in my head here?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, since I'm in a conflict between government intrusion and keeping the private sector from doing things really excellently, isn't this one asset of the business that government should subsidize, the road to the mine, like the Silk Road, like the Chinese are doing the Silk Road all over the world?
Well,
shouldn't we be, America should be committed to helping you all get to Mongolia, providing the discovery is going to come back to the state?
The government actually does have many missions that go to these countries, and because the Westerners are very welcome. I mean, we have stiff competition with China, for example, for minerals globally. And other countries.
Do they also are competitive in excavation, or they're kind of lacking in the
fight? They're competitive in everything.
So they're competitive in finding the stuff as well.
They're
very good.
They're competitive in everything, and you know, we have a lot of really good talented people in the West, and I think we have a competitive edge still potentially. But I think people have already gone to our level and beyond. To be honest, in many instances, which doesn't mean anything bad, because it's a global business and we all collaborate globally. Like when I say to you, we need to do this collectively, not as a human race, look at these problems together. Then what I'm saying to you is, I work with South Americans, I work with Australians, I work with Mongolians, I work with people from Kazakhstan, and these things that divide us should not be. If we're going to solve the problems of our world, we need to work intelligently. Doctors do it, you know. Doctors collaborate globally to try and find, you know, control for diseases. But back to your question.
Do you feel that culturally they're more there are parts of the world that are just more inclined to sciences than other parts of the world, or no? Does everybody, every culture has an interest in mining? Yes or no?
No, I believe mining is very regional. So Africa is a big mining region, South America is a big
But is it Africans helping Westerners come mine in their countries, or is it just Westerners arriving in Africa and saying, hey, you guys got a bunch of stuff, let us mine it?
Well, it used to be that it was Westerners coming in, but there have been enough decades of exploration that a lot of local talent is now the premium talent. For example, you can't get better copper porphyry geologists than the geologists in Chile, for example.
You got to explain that word. That's really good. So that's a long word to spell, too.
So a copper porphyry system is a very large copper system, and in Chile has many deposits that are porphyry copper deposits. Therefore, the geologists that have grown up in this business, that's their expertise. So when you go to a country, say, Kazakhstan or Mongolia, where there's huge mineral potential, but it has not been discovered and built up and produced as in Chile, these guys can take their knowledge, go to these other countries and see things that, you know, other people can't. But that's happening globally. We, you know, Kazakhstan is a perfect example. I call it the next Chile.
Mm.
I believe Kazakhstan is going to come way up in the rankings of a world copper production because it has massive deposits. And that's the opportunity, because why are we there? They have, as of 2017, adopted a legal framework that is patterned after the Western Australian Mining Code, which is one of the best in the world, and made a safe place for foreign investment. And it has elephants to be found in their country. A lot of Soviet era data, where the Soviets did lots of drilling, so you have all this information, but they only drilled to maybe 100 meters, and these things are usually found deeper, and they would leave if they didn't, you know, their whole program was focused on something.
Why would it be so shallow? 100 meters doesn't seem much.
We're talking Soviet era.
Wow.
So nowadays we have the technology and the ability to go deeper and so.
Yeah, maybe they didn't see beyond that.
So basically they've done the surface work for us. We can see what they found, and we can say, this is an interesting area. We need to take this and drill deeper and see what else is here. So there's a data-rich environment. Legal framework was excellent, and opportunities for major discoveries. Every country in the world and every major mining company is courting Kazakhstan. And we were there ahead of
geographically, but not necessarily financially, because they don't have the money to do this themselves?
No. So mining finance is global.
So in other words, what you want, like always, is the money. The visionaries, the money, and the tacit knowledge to find the stuff.
Right.
And then the methods of scale to make it profitable to extract.
So, and in Mongolia, for example, I've got a great story. So the most important thing in mineral exploration is the team. And the team's experience and track record. So I'm with a group of people that have multiple discoveries to their credit, right? And have not only made the discoveries.
This is IG Global, the members, yes.
And that not only have made the discoveries, but they've actually monetized and moved them on and developed them, and et cetera. So Tom Bowens, who's the founder of IG Global, he's a economic geologist from Colorado School of Mines. He calls himself a hillbilly from West Virginia, which is one of my favorite things about him. He was born in a town called Nitro.
Because that's where is that fitting or what?
3M had a nitroglycerin plant there for World War II munitions.
Wow.
So that's where he comes from. Anyway.
And I think we store a bunch of our old weapons in there, too, in those big mines.
Yeah. Across the river, there's a town called Scary. This is West Virginia.
Yeah.
And, but he's an incredible, he's not only super intelligent, but he's creative, entrepreneurial, passionate about science, and an amazing geologist. So years ago, when he first started, he first went to work in Mongolia for a company as a junior geologist. There's a very famous person in my industry. His name is Robert Friedland. He has a company called Ivanhoe Mines that made a massive discovery in Mongolia. And that is now owned by Rio Tinto. And that is a mine that's in construction. The mine is called Oyu Tolgoi. And it will be the fourth largest mine within 10 years in the world.
Wow.
It was a massive discovery. And Tom was working for Friedland at the time, prospecting on some of the large land holdings they had in Mongolia. Mongolia was never thought of as having any mineral wealth until Robert Friedland discovered.
And it's a huge geographic area.
Exactly.
My God.
So Tom ran across, like 22 years ago, he ran across a prospect. He took surface samples that we spoke of earlier, and they came back with incredible grades. And he ended up leaving that company and moving on to another company with another great in the mining industry, a guy called Lucas Lundin, who was an incredible mentor for Tom, and ended up in Far East Russia developing a very large, profitable project. But he always remembered this prospect that he walked over, and he kept watching it for years. And ultimately, 10 years later, the property was dropped by Ivanhoe Mines. And then there was a moratorium on acquiring any new properties in Mongolia for a period.
Again, the government stepping in, or
government stepping in because they were a little bit dizzy with this new discovery, this large mine, and so they needed to sort of figure themselves out for a minute.
Jesus!
But now they
sorry, I didn't mean to say no, Jesus no. Day after Easter.
No, but it's it's.
I mean, oh my God!
It's a normal process, right? Countries have to evolve with the process here. So, but they figured it out, and they've got their framework reset, and the property came up for auction last year. So Tom's been watching this for 22 years. He picked up the property at auction, which is in and of itself amazing, and started doing some additional work on it, confirmed the geochemistry in other areas. Get this. He went back to the area that he walked over 22 years ago, and it was now covered by sands. And he, for a minute, said, wait a minute, am I in the right place? But what he realized was the shifting sands of the Gobi Desert had now covered the outcrop that he found. So he had all his geos go and survey the rest of the land and look for other outcrops. We found other outcrops which had as good or better geochemistry at surface. So we proceeded to do geophysics. The geophysics coincided with the geochemistry, and now we're about to drill it, and we've got multiple strategics signed up to look at what we're doing.
Now, does that mean that you can't go back to the original area because the sands are just
too... No, we did. We can go. We can go drill there. We just can't see them at surface anymore.
Okay.
One of the things that Tom wants to do, because geochemistry is a very good indicator of where you should go for drilling, and this prospect is covered 80% or 90% by the sands of the Gobi Desert, which are shifting. So what you don't want is to be, copper to be taken from one place and deposited somewhere else, and you get the wrong signal.
Right.
But Tom has been elaborating a very well thought out soil sampling program. For example, using an excavator and going X amount deep under the surface where it will not have moved, and doing a soil sampling program to help with the geochemistry for this deposit because it's massive. This will be, we're looking for the next Oyu Tolgoi, which I just described to you.
Yeah, that means something in Mongolian, I suppose.
So Oyu Tolgoi, yes. And it is. If you look it up, you'll see it's re-owned by Rio Tinto now. It's had open pit production. They're going underground. It's a very profitable, high-grade mine, and it's changed the landscape of Mongolia, absolutely. And we're 65 kilometers from it. And in sandwiched between two big mines. So there's Oyu Tolgoi and then there's Karmaktai. And our deposit is right in between the two on the trend. So we're very excited about the future of that.
Okay.
And it's very unusual to have strategic. When I say strategics, I mean the big mines.
Yeah, what you said earlier. Chances are, be next to other mines.
Well, yeah. So strategics, they get interested in junior mining companies, which is what we are. The juniors do the exploration and the majors are into the business of producing. But imagine we're at an early stage of this prospect, but it's so intriguing and so interesting that the majors are already wanting to talk to us. So,
and is there an advantage or disadvantage to have them fund your mine as opposed to?
Well, I have a
private investors.
I have a particular view. There's two ways to do this. You can either try to go public with what information you have. It's still very high risk, and the public is not as savvy as, let's say, strategic. And you can dilute yourself and try to meet all the regulations requirements, which are crazy for a junior mining company to actually succeed, and try to do it that way. And I think that is a not the best use of energy and money. I prefer to stay private until it's an obvious, very advanced project,
yeah.
Right? And partner with people who really know what they're looking at. So when you got to bring money in from somewhere. To help you, these are massive projects, right? At the end of the day, But you can leverage with a deal up front where you build into the deal success payments to the original discoverers, right? But you also get the capital as well as the expertise of a strategic to collaborate with you on the development. And I think that's, to me, that's my preferred way to go. So, and some of these companies nowadays have technology either developed in-house or that they're using that can help speed up that discovery process. So we're intrigued by that. And I think, you know, our preference is to do something strategic at this point.
So what kind of money are you talking here?
So let me just layer this
in. One partner, two partners, a group of partners.
IG Asia is the holding company where we have our investors, okay?
That are already in place.
That are already in place. And we're looking for some new investors. We're doing a seed round, actually, for $1.5 million for 8% of our company, which is IG Asia. And the assets...
Did you say 8% or 8?
8.
Okay.
8%. And the assets are this prospect in Mongolia, as well as projects in Kazakhstan. We have an advanced copper asset in Kazakhstan, which has economics around it. We are about to announce it. I can't give you any more information until
it's secret.
Until I can, not because we have to hold the information for ourselves, but we have a confidentiality with a major company.
I can imagine that world must be half of it confidentiality agreements.
So here we are. We're actually in conversations with strategics that it doesn't take away. We're not giving away our properties. We're actually keeping our properties and getting strategics involved to help the development of them. And when you talk about the development of a project from, let's say, discovery to production, we're talking, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. But if we're just talking about discovery to defining a deposit, it could be anywhere from, you know, 5 to 20 million, right? And if you're talking about going the next level to engineering studies, then you get into the $40, $50 million range, and then a final bankable feasibility could take $100 million.
So there wouldn't do the private groups back off when it goes to the $40, $50 million range in the engineering portion of it? Or is it discovery investment money get actually paid from the $40, $50 million when they're, I don't know, bought out? Or
right.
How does that work?
Okay, so the investors at our IG global level have a stake in each of these properties, right? And we're going to be doing deals that not only bring money and payments into the top co, but also have increasing payments or value recognition as the projects develop. So we have at the top co investor level, there are potential monetization events through certain milestone payments, for example, or we could ultimately sell the asset altogether, which often is the biggest monetization event and one that is the most likely because it will be taken out by a major company at some point, right? And you can retain a royalty and other streams of income.
For that investment group.
Right.
And what kind of return can a private investor who puts up $1.5 million by themselves, one person, what can they expect in that event?
Depends on how early you get on the investment.
Mm.
So, for example, right now...
In other words, the riskier, the less unknowns, you invest blindly in the 1.5 based on limited information.
Exactly.
You get more money if there's a find,
right,
as opposed to having the find, then give the 1.5, your returns are lower.
Exactly. And a perfect example is we had a project in Utah that we developed in very short period of time. The earliest investors, when there was nothing but... No, it was an old mining district, so we definitely went to a previous area that had all the smoke, right?
Okay.
Which is where we go where it's big and there's smoke.
Okay.
We don't go completely blind. The first investors, when we had to go and rehab rat infested, you know, offices and things like that and compile historical information, came in at a dollar. And before we sold to a mid-tier company, the last round we did was at $10. You can imagine how much the person made when they invested $1 versus the person that made $10. So really, right now, we are on the cusp of, at IG Global, of making that re-rate of valuation. But we need that $1.5 million and willing to give up the 8% to get through these negotiations.
Now, when the person gives up the invested $10, does the $1 guy get $9 or do they stay?
Well, so everybody has bought a unit or a share, right? Mm-hmm. So our companies are private partnerships, so you get the equivalent of a share. It's called a membership unit.
Mm-hmm.
And that membership unit is the same in terms of the entire percentage. So if you paid $1 for, let's say, 1,000 units, then that would be your basis, right? It would be $1,000.
And you decide whether you want to sell at that time or you want to stay with the group or no. Or that's actually, that makes sense that it would be signed.
This is the investor.
Okay.
Right?
So they expect to get out.
The guy who puts $10 in has to pay $10,000 for the same 1,000 units.
Okay.
Okay, so their basis is higher than the other person's basis. And therefore, when you have a monetizing event, that money comes in, then if each person gets 20,000, then the guy who invested $1 makes that difference, and the guy invested 10, you know, makes that difference. So it really depends on when you invest. So
But my question is, does that person out or does that person stay?
No, because these are monetizing events.
So they take their profit and go, or they take a profit knowing that they're going to stay in and make more?
Both.
Okay, both.
Okay. So if we sell the entire company, for example, that will be the last monetization event for everybody.
Yes.
Okay. But if we sell the asset and we keep a royalty, or then there's multiple monetization events until the moment where we sell the entire company, for example. So you can make money on different stages, shall we say, but it all has to be on monetization, right? So monetization could be we got paid for 20% of the project, and then we sold 40% later, right? And then when we sell the whole thing, then that'll be the last monetization event. So that's basically, there's so many thoughts.
Yeah, there's a bunch of variables there.
But let me just boil it down. Early stage investment is very high risk. So the team is very important. The track record of the team is very important. The location is very important, that people know what they're doing. But the experience is extraordinary. It's a very incredibly interesting business to be in. And if you can afford to put your money at risk, for example, at the seed round, which is the highest risk, which is what we're doing now. In fact, we're doing the very first round of financing that we did was at $1. And to all this, let me just say that
these are the back to Mongolia and...
Yeah, so we're back to IG Asia. Back to IG Asia.
Okay.
Tom Bowens went to Kazakhstan. He lives in Almaty. He's got his whole office base there. And of course, the Mongolia he's been there historically, and we have an office there. But he went there with nothing but his ideas, right? And he put $4 million of his own money into it. So he's the biggest shareholder, right? Then we have the management that has also put money into it, but we put money in at a valuation of $1, and we're doing this round at another seed round of at $1.25 for the 8%. Now we expect a re-rate very quickly based on the announcement of what we're going to do in Kazakhstan with this advanced copper asset, as well as what we want to do in Mongolia with this beast that we've got our hands on.
So the investor would get a part of both.
So the investor would get part of both because they're investing at the top co, and they would go on the ride with us. We have less than 50 investors, and you know, if you
and everybody puts a 1-5, or they're lesser or more of that group of 50.
So of the group of 50 investors, the biggest investment outside of Tom is about $600,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the smallest investment of like a friends and family would be 5, 10, 15. So.
Oh, really? So you welcome that as well. You welcome the real believers, you know, the people who would just do it.
Well, Tom this is his third iteration. He made money for people with his project in Far East Russia, which was an incredible story of its own. We made money for people in Utah, and now those same people are reinvesting with us now. So you definitely have a group of believers.
Yeah, it's the science of hope, man. It's really impressive. Now,
it's also the science of performance. This guy delivered.
Yeah, yeah.
And he puts his own money there, and you know, he's a
but even he, when he arrives, he arrives on a hope, you know, because of his knowledge.
But it's
amazing. The art, it's so beautiful. It's just what makes everything go around. The whole world revolves this way, and it starts there.
But it's very,
it's fascinating.
It's very calculating, though, at the same time, because he's a geologist, a
scientist,
as well as a business person.
There's no monkey business here, man. Like there's no marketing.
His ambition is to create wealth, not just for himself, but for hundreds of people.
Yes.
Right? And then, you know, solve problems of humanity. Like he's just that guy, and he lives it. He gets excited by it.
Here's a segue question, and you tell me if this is going to go anywhere. What is it that he sees that AI can bring to this? Does it cut his thought process in half, or
he wants to compete with it?
Oh, he wants to compete. Great answer.
He's excited to put his knowledge and abilities and visions alongside what AI and machine learning can
and ask the AI, am I right or am I wrong?
Well, and
guess what? You're wrong, AI. I'm right.
Exactly.
That's
he's
incredible.
He's actually really fascinated by that because, you know, there's no downside for him. He's got all of his experience and knowledge, and he knows what he's doing.
No, and someone has
to input this stuff in AI.
But if
that same data that he's looking at goes into some AI and machine learning and spits out some interesting things and they go test it, and it can shorten the time of discovery or enhance his own understanding or knowledge in some way, then it's win-win.
Wow. It's just quantum physics, it seems.
It's like, really cool.
Wow.
We're currently in discussions with a group that has an AI. It's pretty exciting. And there's actually two groups that are speaking to us.
All right. Well, there is a part two to this interview, I guess. You promise to come back?
Yes. It probably won't be next week.
But no, I fully understand. It's just, as long as you don't move from the key, man, the key's like the epicenter of the world as far as I'm concerned.
You know, it's very difficult to find investors that, you know, have that vision and appetite. And so that does discourage me. Plus, the laws in the United States make it really difficult to fundraise here.
And there's no tax benefits by the U.S. government to encourage people to mine in the United States for products in the United States?
There are tax benefits in Canada.
The U.S. is that brain dead? My God.
You know, I don't think it's brain dead. I think there are many people with fantasy.
No, I'm talking about government only.
No.
I find government to be brain dead.
Well, let me just complete my thought. I think there are a lot of really smart people. The problem is no one can get anything done. So you're always opposed.
Well, the left hand is not watching the right hand. What's the reason for that? Bureaucratic culture. Well, brain deadness.
Well, and it's also this fiefdom type thing. Like, you know, if a good idea can't come from the other side, it has to come from my side.
Yes.
If someone, I don't want them to.
It's incredible we can accomplish if no one's worried about who takes the credit.
Exactly. And so I see it over and over again. Really good ideas come out, good programs come out, they get attacked by the other side. And instead of having, at the end of the day, something meaningful, we have this mishmash of more bureaucracy, basically, because it's just been not brought through. I mean, if I were to start a political party, it would be the pragmatic party. We'd take a problem and we'd look for the most pragmatical solution by getting the smartest people in the room and people with experience, obviously, because just because you're smart doesn't mean you're experienced.
Right.
And I'm done with the labels of everybody. I just want to get problems
solved. No, you're falling into the no labels party now.
Well, no, I just want to get problems solved.
Yeah. My God, and the thing is that the stakes are high. My God, the future of humanity requires not only that, but the density of the human race, because we're more people. It requires urgency, man.
This is what
we like to emphasize. This is why I enjoyed this conversation with you, is that you can't get anything more urgent than a blink. And the name of the station is Blink Radio. So you got to do things in a blink, and for Christ's sake, humanity depends on it. Our needs, our wants, our desires all depend on it. My God, and that, and when you think of the core of what we depend on, my God, it's mining.
I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. And not only that, it's a fascinating thing.
Not only that, you got Elon Musk wanting to go to Mars to mine because there's no regulation up there.
He could just
decide his own rules up there.
Same with the moon, right?
Just mine the hell out of the place.
The moon, right?
Yeah, and also we look up at the moon and it's a little bit smaller.
I mean, if we try and solve problems in other planets, then we have this one here and smart people and we have solutions and we just got to get out of the way.
Yeah, I yeah. So please.
And educate people. Like I will sit and talk to anybody who would like to talk to me. If anybody would like to have coffee with me.
Okay. Email, phone number. Yeah. Repeat it. It's radio. You have to do it twice.
Okay. So if you would like to talk to me further about mineral exploration, my name is Stephanie Ashton. My phone number is 305-934-1612. That's 305-934-1612. And my email is sashton@igglobalgroup.com. That's sashton@igglobalgroup.com. I look forward to anybody who would like to collaborate in our exciting business.
I think that this is a very exciting interview, especially because it throws me away from all the humdrum stuff I normally do.
Well, so, when I ran into you, you say, yeah. What do you do? I'm in mineral exploration. That's immediately a conversation opener.
Nobody, yeah, man.
Like, nobody.
And I had a little bit of experience. I had dipped my toes in the water in my conversations with Steve. And I was fascinated how it went. I remember the lunch meetings and I remember the people involved. And I could tell that he could talk the lexicon and that I couldn't. So I had to just do what I do best, started eating the food. And then you come along, I think maybe 5 years had gone by, and boy, you reignited all this interest, and I can't thank you enough. So I really appreciate you coming by today.
Well, I can't thank you enough for having me and being interested and doing what you do, because you at Blink Radio are providing a service to all of us for the creatives, for the entrepreneurs, for the people who are going to build the changes in the world that we need.
Well, guess what the next song is? Alan Gray, I Am No Angel. How about that?
Okay, let's do it.
Take care and stay free, my friends. If you like our programming on WSQF 94.5 in Key Biscayne, you can also hear us very far away nationwide, WSQFradio.com. And if you like our audio files and our subject matter, subscribe to YouTube, Mac on the Rock Rampage. Take care and stay free.